Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 34 years of law enforcement analysis experience. She's earned her doctorate of business administration, specializing in criminal justice from North Central University. She's a Florida certified law enforcement analyst and a certified law enforcement criminal justice instructor. She currently is assistant professor at Florida A&M University and adjunct professor at Tiffin University. Please welcome Annie Thompson. Annie, how are we doing?
How are we doing, Jason? I'm doing just fine. Doing just fine.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for being on the show. And for those that don't know, Annie and I actually live in the same city. We both live in Tallahassee. If, under different circumstances, we would probably be doing this interview face-to-face. But with COVID, we are in separate places right now.
Trying to keep that social distancing.
Let's talk how you discovered law enforcement analysis. And this stems back to the 80s. So we're going to take a trip back in time first thing.
Yeah, we're going to take a real trip back. I actually graduated from FAMU in 1981 with a business and accounting as my minor degree. At the time I graduated, there were no jobs. A lot of jobs had just started putting freezes on hiring. And I remembered that FDLE had some positions opening up. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to apply, you know, get my foot in the door and see what the job is about. And it might be something I end up using my business degree with. Now, you know, with business, you have a lot of that background, a lot of math, a lot of writing, a lot of critical thinking. So I never had any idea that all of those things would come into play when I actually joined FDLE. And when I got my first exposure to intelligence, it was working in the Florida Intelligence Center. Loved the people I was working with, doing some stuff with organized crime, special interest groups, and then got real, real interested on the analytical side of it. It became a CIA one, Crime Intelligence Analyst one, and progressed to a Crime Intelligence Analyst two. And did that until I left the agency in 1990 to join the Tallahassee Police Department in a management position. So that's pretty much how I got my foot in the door. I had no interest whatsoever in working in law enforcement. But once I started doing it, I didn't look back. I've been doing it ever since, even as teacher. As a professor now, I'm still involved with criminal justice, law enforcement type subjects and topics. If I had to narrow it down to a particular period that really got my attention with analysis is when I started working with sex crimes against kids. And I know a lot of people saying, oh my God, who wants to do that? Somebody's got to do the hard work. And that's probably one of my most rewarding jobs. I'd still be doing it today if it had been a place for me to do it.
Just for those that may not know, FDLE is Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
Yes.
Let's get into your time in this sex crimes against children's unit. What kind of tasks are you doing? What's your responsibility?
Well, from the initial point, we literally take intelligence, raw intelligence, on potential subjects who may have been offenders or alleged offenders who are abusing young kids. And over the state of Florida, you know, a lot of people don't like to admit that it's a major problem, but it is, especially in some of your more rural areas. And one of the things that unit did was to collect the information, but also actively collect the information so it could be used for further prosecution of the cases or developing potential suspects, developing even more victims or more witnesses to the incidents that were occurring. I even got to participate pretending to be a 15-year-old girl, writing some of the letters and working with the postmaster in an effort to apprehend one of our suspects that was, in my book, a real bad guy. A lot of the information we got to look at, it's, you know, some of the information was very disturbing. Pictures, even video, handling some of the evidence, putting together exhibits on pieces of information that can support other pieces of information, trying to show different ways individuals were linked to each other or associated with each other, whether it was loosely or very strong. And actually trying to build a solid case that when the investigators got ready to take it to the next level, whether it was going to be to the state attorney's office or whoever's in charge of cases for a certain jurisdiction, it could pretty much stand on its own. And I remember one time we actually, in some of the property that was confiscated, there was the powder blue and navy blue van, and it became a nickname in the unit, the pedo van. I mean, that van was equipped with everything, the nice carpet, the nice paneling on the inside. So it gave me a real rewarding feeling to know that we were a part of putting this guy behind bars, especially with some of the things he had done to some of the young kids. I mean, everything from looking at the paperwork to actually handling some of the evidence is what I got to do. And then on the back end, when we would have our annual training opportunities that actually do trainings statewide, whether we go to the North Florida, stay in North Florida, go to Central Florida, even down South Florida, and put on these conferences. And my real interest in doing further work with that is learning how to use anatomically correct dolls. And I'll never forget when it was time for me to go get my instructor certification, I used that as the basis of my whole 80-hour plan to get certified to teach criminal justice courses and learn how to use those anatomically correct dolls. And even after I left the unit, I had occasion to even do some presentations on what parents could look for, what other people could look for, what are some of the red flags when you're talking about kids being sexually abused. And in my classes now that I teach at FAMU, whenever I'm talking about theories of criminal behavior, I even get to bring some of those experiences and examples into the classroom.
Yeah, just for in case those that might not know, why would dolls be used in terms of an investigation for sex crimes against children?
Well, a lot of times this is on the adults. We don't teach our kids the correct body parts. We give them nicknames. And when it comes to investigations, the investigators or whoever is conducting the investigations cannot just openly ask somebody, did they touch a particular part, and then lead that victim on to say what you said. So you want to at least be able to have the dolls, let them point to a place, show you a place or whatever. And when they do that, they're confirming what happened to them based on what they see with the dolls, not necessarily you suggesting, was it here? Was it there? Was it, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So they actually get to show you on the dolls, and the dolls are anatomically correct. Everything, the body parts on the girl dolls are the female dolls. Same thing with the males are the boy dolls.
You're working for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. So are you handling cases all over Florida, or is it just in Tallahassee at this time?
No, it wasn't just in Tallahassee. In fact, a lot of the investigations we worked would have been initiated by a complaint that came in. Sometimes those complaints would come through the governor's office, and they can dictate when your FDLE units need to investigate a particular case that may have come anywhere in Florida. I remember some cases being down past the Orlando area. One of the bigger cases that I worked on before I left the unit was out of the Fort Walton Beach area. So wherever that initial complaint comes from, the case is going to stem from that area.
And this is the late 80s that you're doing this. So this is before the internet. And what's a scenario of how these perpetrators are getting in contact with children?
Well, the ones that we work, some of them either initiated through contact with the kids at some daycare centers, mm-hmm. or some where you've got a place where you've got an offender who likes to hang around where playgrounds and a lot of children are. Wherever kids usually populated, that's where your drawing point was for some of these. I call them perverts because that's just what they were. Mm-hmm. And it just made the kids were more vulnerable to be victims.
And then as an analyst, what are the challenges that you have working these cases?
The challenges is always, the biggest thing is always, number one, trying to find somebody who's willing to provide the information, witness, if you want to call them a witness, or a person who can give you information that can either substantiate the claim, someone who can give you information to, if not substantiate it, but maybe point you in a direction where you might be able to gather some more information that can support the claim, then you can conduct your investigation more successfully that way. The challenge again, too, is when you're dealing with children, young kids, the communication barrier. You have some who are very, very young and don't have an established communication. You have some who've probably been abused so much and they're complete introverts, and it takes a lot to get information out of them. So the biggest challenge was always trying to develop some type of communication between you and the person you're actually interviewing. We had an awesome team. Our investigators and the supervisor in that unit did an awesome job with the investigations. I observed some. I didn't get to ask any of those questions because I was not a sworn person, but I did the support work in the unit and did the analytical end of it.
The internet now, I mean, it's just a whole new ball game with what's going on today versus what's going on then. I'm sure there's just like anything else. So there's probably more awareness now, but at the same time, there's also more avenues for contact between perverts, like you say, and children.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention the internet. So many jurisdictions, not just in Florida, but all over the United States, don't want to admit that sex trafficking and human trafficking, especially of young kids, is as big as it is. Human trafficking in itself is a billion-dollar industry, multi-billion-dollar industry. And then when you start breaking it down into actually looking at things like your labor trafficking, where you're using these young kids to do all of this labor and you're hiding them from the government, you're not paying them. And then you got the sex trafficking where you're pushing them through prostitution and pornography. And a lot of times these young people are so afraid to say anything or even reach out to anybody for help. That's how they're able to, you know, under the radar. But then all it takes is one person seeing a picture or something, or seeing someone that looks familiar. And I remember not too long ago in the Tallahassee area, they did a sting and I think they arrested something like 78 people, but it was a 2 or 3 year investigation that culminated, but they were able to track some of this activity via the internet. Whenever I'm speaking to my class or we're doing panel discussions, trying to get everybody to realize the dangers of the internet. Great tool to have, technology is wonderful, but there are some pitfalls, and that's one of them.
As you mentioned, you would do that the rest of your life, but you decide to become a supervisor.
I had to become a manager.
Yeah, you just had to?
Well, let's put it this way. I had been at FDLE about 8.5 years. I was actually about a year from being vested. I could have stayed there another year and been vested, but an opportunity came up with Tallahassee Police Department, and I couldn't say no. And especially since it was almost like an extension of what I was doing, although it was not working state cases, it was working on the local level. Mm-hmm. But the idea of still working in some field related to crime analysis, and even in the crime analysis unit, we also did intelligence, it still kept me within that same realm of responsibility. The difference was I was now a manager, but I was one of those managers that I considered myself to be a working manager. I didn't just sit behind the desk and push a pencil. If I needed to get in there and get my hands dirty with the analyst, I did that. So I was a working analyst, but still got to do some of the intelligence and the crime analysis stuff. adding in the mapping, adding in some of your community policing components. So we were trying to be a well-rounded unit and serve in different aspects as it related to the field.
How many folks are you in supervising at this time?
When I first started, believe it or not, I had 4 analysts, crime analysts, 1 show cap analyst, and then I had an auto theft analyst. And then, of course, as you know, as things start to change with government, one of those positions was a contract OPS position. And once you have a contract position, if they don't renew it the next year, that position goes away. But the duty or the responsibility doesn't go away. So you end up revamping the unit so you can absorb those duties. And then I think probably about 5 years after that, when another analyst left to go do another job, I didn't get to fill that position because now the city was divided into 3 districts as opposed to being 4. And when I left, they were down to, was it 2 analysts and then a show cop analyst, but it wasn't in that unit. It was actually in our criminal investigations division. And the unit was serving 2 districts. We had the North and the South district as opposed to quadrants or either 3 sections. Yeah. It's funny to see how it evolved.
So I find it interesting from your perspective, you're coming into this police department as a supervisor, not being an analyst there yourself and not having managerial experience. How was that transition for you?
Actually, the transition was a little bit smooth because the lieutenant that I was reporting to, and he's deceased now, he had a plan or a vision of some things that he wanted done. Number one, types of reports created some of the quote unquote written reports, and I had to do an exercise and he liked my writing. And then, you know, with the oral interview, some of the questions he asked about standard deviation and asked about hot spots and policing and how do you do community policing. And so we took some of those answers and responses that I gave him and tried to formulate a plan, and we followed that. And the rest is history. We just kept kind of building on that, detracting from it, adding more to it, revising as we moved through the years.
Do you have any special memory during your time here in Tallahassee while you were the crime analysis and GIS supervisor?
Oh, wow. We had a lot of good ones. I guess if anything, the one moment that I think my entire unit and I will always remember, we did get a commendation from, at that time, it was Chief Dennis Jones, for our efforts to not only provide the information to our patrol officers or the operational side, but also provide assistance when criminal investigations needed assistance, either from some of the analysts or some of the tools we were working with, like analyst notebook or some of the mapping equipment and some of the mapping apps we were using, but also providing the customer service to the public. Our unit also was responsible when, before we made our police statistics available to the public, they could call and get some basic or generic information from that unit. And so some of our thank yous and we appreciate you would come from the public. And of course, it would get to the chief. Like I said, the unit just did a lot of different things and served a lot of different people. So that commendation, I still look at it sometimes today because it means a lot.
So then you make a major change. You take your managerial skills there and you head up to Fairfax County, Virginia. So yes. Just talk to me about the decision to, you've been in Tallahassee all your career, and now you make the decision to head up to Fairfax County, Virginia, which for those that don't know Virginia very much, that's Northern Virginia. So that's right outside of Washington, D.C.
Correct. Well, the only reason I actually ended up leaving was nowhere else for me to go. Mm-hmm. And I, at that time, was actually working on my PhD, trying to get that finished up because I was trying to map out, what do I want to do next? I'd marked off a few things off my bucket list, and I wanted to challenge myself. wanted to go outside of the state of Florida, go to North United States. It was a rewarding experience, but I had some personal stuff going on. I think I had been there maybe 2-3 months, and I get a call from home that my father's cancer had come back, and this time it was terminal. Probably 6 months after that, I get a call that my mom has progressive dementia. And it was taxing being that far away from home. I would even literally, every time there was a holiday, I was flying back to Tallahassee. It was quite a challenge. And when I finally finished up the PhD, and my dad said, you know, you can get a job in Florida. And I made the decision. It was time to come back home.
I'm sorry to hear that about your folks.
Yeah,
but
yeah. So I lost him shortly after he had that little talk with me. And then I came back home in June. I actually defended my dissertation while I was up in Virginia, and then started with Tiffin in July. And I've been with FAMU for the last 3 years now.
So then as you're going up there to Fairfax, what shocked you the most? What was your maybe lessons learned as making that jump from Tallahassee to Fairfax?
If I had to say anything, that the traffic, oh my Jesus. You know, you watch it on TV, but nothing actually prepares you for it. Mm-hmm. And then I used to always hear people talk about DMV. I'm like, what? District of Columbia, Maryland, Virginia. And they all kind of merge right there. And when you're on that interstate, that interstates that look like they go 50 million directions all at one time. Uh-huh. And yes, I did get lost my first time. I decided to venture out and see where it would take me. But enough signs to get me back where I needed to go. I love cold weather, so the cold weather didn't bother me, but no one prepared me for the snow Armageddon that I got my first year up there and had to telework from home for a couple of weeks because you couldn't go out on the road. It was too much snow. I still look at those pictures today, but the culture, pretty much the same. You know, law enforcement, still serving the public, still looking at your statistical data, still looking at the mapping applications that you can use. I got there, learned how to use Tableau, fell in love with it. If I could afford to keep that personally on my computer, I would. Awesome application. Got exposed to a lot of different things. Their substations are set up totally different from how I thought it would be. You know, you think about substations, and in Tallahassee is not that large, and we used to have substations. They closed those all down and brought everything back to the central location. Up there, their substations were bigger than the whole Tallahassee Police Department. But with the way the buildings were organized, very nice buildings, but you can go from one section of the general county to another, and you can see the differences in the, I guess you could call it, the communities you were serving, even with some of the people. You can tell areas that were probably more advantaged than others. And you can tell too that you had some neighborhoods that were better taken care of than some others. Same kind of scenarios that you would find in Tallahassee, just a little bit different makeup.
And then you mentioned Tableau. We haven't mentioned Tableau on this show yet. So for those that don't know what Tableau is, it's a dashboard program. So Annie, I'm just kind of curious, maybe go over some of the functions that analysts can use by using Tableau.
Oh, wow. Tableau allows you not only to do some cool reporting, but it also allows you to do some cool mapping within the reporting. One of the coolest things too is, let's say you create a report. I had to do the NIBRS report, thinking about UCR in Florida, their NIBRS report. They use NIBRS up there. So if you've got the report done and you go to the dashboard, it's interactive. Wherever you click on that entire dashboard, something is going to happen and you can actually see it changing right before your face. When you're working with it too, you can do a lot of quote unquote statistical type reports. And there are some can also create some customized reports for you too. Like I said, if I could afford to have it on my computer personally, I would use it for some of my work I do for FAMU. Believe it or not, FAMU uses Tableau. Our entire office that provides stats for the entire university or annual reporting, whatever, I don't have it because I don't have a need, because the licenses cost so much money. But a great way to show interactive reporting, a way to make your statistics come to life. A lot of times when we were in crime analysis and you do these reports, you can do them really nice. You can take the time and do them really nice. Excel allows you to do some cool stuff too. But Tableau, just the way it organized it and gave you the final report, was so kind of finished looking.
I've used Tableau, and one of the things I like about it is it allows drill downs upon drill downs upon drill downs. Yes. Right. So if you want to know the details behind these numbers, you can get there. You can get all the way down to the most granular level possible.
Right. And
it's very helpful as an analyst or as a developer. You can create these dashboards and then the user can navigate it themselves. So they go in there and whatever they want to see, whatever they want to click on, they can do all the navigating and analyze the data themselves.
And the other thing, which I failed to mention, I guess you would call it your original data that's generating the dashboards or the views that you have. If you ever need to have something modified, you can set your settings where you go and you can modify it, and it's going to update it wherever that piece of data that you just updated is being used in those interactive dashboards. Touch it once. Ohio, only handle it once.
Okay, good. So you come back to Tallahassee, and I see on here that you have a civil rights specialist where you worked with the Florida Commission on Offender Review.
Yes.
What were some of your responsibilities there?
The biggest responsibility there was when a prisoner or someone who had been released from jail wanted to apply to get their rights back, whether it was voting rights, whether it was the right to carry a weapon, and their Florida statutes dictates whether they could or they couldn't. We had to verify if all of their fines had been paid, if they had any outstanding fines that needed to be paid. We could forward the case to an investigator to do further investigations. And then we literally write a letter either approving it, denying it, or saying it's pending, depending on the person paying any outstanding fines, or if there's a certain amount of the fine. There was a cutoff. If there was only a certain amount and the person had not reoffended the entire time they had been out of jail, we could make the recommendation that the fine could be not necessarily forgotten and almost like a forgiven fine, because it met that requirement. The biggest thing was, though, that a lot of the people who had sent in their requests to get their rights back, you got to understand at that time, Florida was extremely backlogged, and sometimes people would send in multiple requests, 3, 4, 5. I can remember one case that I worked had actually maybe six times. But by the time we got to that man's case to even review it to see if he could get his rights restored, the person may have died. So I know that the Offender Review Commission had worked really hard on getting extra people hired so that they can address that backlog. And then when we had the vote a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, where Amendment 4 was pretty much saying that the prisoners could get their rights back. But of course, saying that they can get their rights back and it actually happening, there's some more work that has to be done there. But that's primarily what the job entailed: reviewing, using a lot of secured systems, use FCIC, NCIC, some of your Interpol stuff, all of those same resources I used when I worked as an analyst back in FDLE at the 80s, some of those have come back around, using the jail databases, all of the places where you can verify records and arrests and offenses that they committed. Some offenses committed allowed you to make the recommendation that they could get their rights back. Some could not.
Now, the jail data, how would you rate that data? Is that pretty good data in terms of what you needed to get out of it? Or is there a lot of gaps in that data?
Well, because a lot of it is tied directly to probation and parole feeding into it. So you've got the jail data, but you've got probation and parole data. And then where the gaps were, it, believe it or not, it really wasn't that bad, except if a, let's just say a parole officer or a probation officer did not completely fill out if they, the person had met all of their sanctions or completed all of their sanctions, but the person has paperwork indicating you're free and clear. You know what I mean? You're mm-hmm. off probation, you're done, but you didn't have it exactly entered in the system where it needed to be. It was probably like 3 or 4 screens you need to look at, and it's on 2 of those screens, but not on the other 2. So that would be a challenge because you got to go look at all of them to make sure that they're all reconciled. That would be the biggest thing that I would find with the jail data.
All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to get into your work as a professor, getting your doctorate, and advice that you have for our listeners.
Okay.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Jeffrey Vandersip, and I'm going to tell you about a couple of my pet peeves. Pet peeve number one is the size of parking lots at grocery stores. They create these parking lots for Yugos, and yet everybody is now driving a Ford F-150, and you can't fit in anything, or if you do, you're banging the doors of your neighbors. Pet peeve number two is the little button in cars that open the fuel filler door seems to be in the most oddest of places. And whenever I go somewhere else and I rent a car and I have to go to the gas station for the first time, I spend a half hour trying to figure out how to open the fuel filler door. Pet peeve number three is just packaging generally with things that you get in the mail. It's like Russian nesting dolls. You've got a box, and inside that box is another box. Inside that is another box. Inside that is a bubble wrap. And then you get to like a little piece of whatever, which is the thing actually sent. And finally, and again, betraying my age here, the screen filters that people use in their social media, everybody kind of looks like somebody out of Avatar. What's up with that?
Welcome back. Annie, I want to talk about your desire to get a doctorate. What inspired you to get your doctorate?
I've always enjoyed teaching at some level, whether it's doing presentations, whether it's teaching people how to use PowerPoint or teaching people how to write effective reports. And I've always, in the back of my mind, I said, man, it'll be cool for me to go back to my alma mater and teach. So when the opportunity presented itself, I was like, all right, I'm in. One of the things I always wanted to do was serve in a mentorship type role. And I'm fortunate enough to do that because that's one of the requirements of my position. Yes, it's to instruct and teach as a professor, but there's that other responsibility where you mentor students on not just coming to class and doing the work, but what does it take to be productive? What are some of the life learning lessons you need to learn? They need to know the importance of being responsible for meeting deadlines. And when you do work, don't just do it just to be doing it. What are the requirements to make it look professional, to make it look good, to make it not only represent the student, but at the end of the day, it's actually representing the university. One of the things that I've worked with my students on as well is trying to get them to write academically and formally so that if they opt to write something that they want to publish or either write something that they can use as a professional example of their ability to write well, that's where I spend a lot of my time. Believe it or not, in criminal justice courses, you might not think you have to do a lot of writing to that type of degree, but you do. Everything from the types of topics that I introduce to the students and how it needs to be written and why it's important to write a certain way so that if a reader picks it up, they're literally following the journey that a student intended for them to follow when they they actually did the writing. It's more than just putting words together. You got to think about what you're writing. And they always laugh at me. They call me Dr. T. So I'm like, Dr. T, you're so funny. I'm like, yeah, I can be funny, but I can be serious too when it comes to this work. Because I try to instill in them, you don't write the way you talk. You definitely don't write the way you text. We know that. But you really have to think about it. So one of the elements we try to bring into the classroom too is professional development. Some of these students are going to apply for internships. They need to be prepared. They need to understand that when you go on these internships, you're stepping into a quote unquote professional environment, but you still have to take the attitude, all right, I'm a student, but I've got to carry myself or represent myself as a professional. So the professional development with that, plus trying to write and be a mentor. This last year has been really, really crazy with the COVID. Mm-hmm. And I've had some students who literally felt like, you know, I can't do this school thing anymore. And I would go, stop. You're this close. What is it that's frustrating you so that you feel like you can't continue just a little bit more? You're on schedule to graduate at the end of the spring. You're on schedule to graduate this summer or this fall. What? It's just a matter that I just need someone to listen to me vent. And I said, we all need that. I said, let's vent. So I literally give them the opportunity. And I know you think it's crazy. Mm-hmm. One of my classes we had a day and I said, okay, for 10 seconds, I'm going to let y'all yell, scream, say whatever the heck you want to say. Mm-hmm. This is the only time you get to do that. And so, you know, I give them the opportunity to do that and then even try to meet the students where they are. I even did an assignment in class where they had to tweet me and they looked at me like I was crazy. I said, yeah, I know about y'all social media stuff. So part of the assignment was to tweet me. And that was just to break the class up a little bit, mm-hmm. to let them know, yeah, professors have to be professors, but we're human just like you guys are. And yeah. I think it's real, real big when they see that we do try to be understanding, try to still be a mentor to help them understand what their real responsibility is when they come to college. College isn't cheap. And I tell them all the time, I'm sure your mom and your dad didn't send you here just to say you're going to be a quitter.
Back to the writing, what are your normal tips that you tell your students or anybody for that matter of how to improve your writing?
One of the first things I always tell people when they're trying to improve their writing, make an outline, whether it's very structured or whether it's loosely structured, it doesn't really matter. And the reason I say that is when you make an outline, you're giving yourself a guide, what you need to follow in order to make sure the thoughts you put together make sense and get a point across that you're trying to get across in a paper. The other reason you make that outline too is to focus on the main points. I always tell people when you're writing academically or writing formally, it's not really about you. It's not the I all the way through. You're writing a piece that sounds like someone professionally wrote it. And so I always encourage them, you got to go back, refine. The first time you write it, you go back and read it, I guarantee you, you're going to find four or five things wrong with it. And you keep doing that until you get it to I call it a fine point where it reads well. One of the other big things I always tell them to try to organize your thoughts to match the paragraph. So if you've got that outline, match your paragraphs to those thoughts that you're trying to portray. And you can always move those paragraphs around so that they flow. The transition from one idea to the next actually makes sense when somebody's reading that paper. To think collectively, what's the main point you're trying to get across? Did you get that point across? And then at the end of the day, how you conclude those thoughts to let the reader know that it's wrapped up and you're done. So trying to get you to organize more and focus more on the main ideas of what you're thinking about is one of the best ways to write better.
There's a difference, or there can be a difference between what you write in an academic paper versus what you're going to most likely write as a professional, right?
Oh,
I mean, unless as a professional, you're hired to write in terms of law enforcement analysis. I mean, if you're there to write strategic papers or intelligence papers, But for the most part, law enforcement analysis, writing what you did in college is different from what you're going to be expected to write in the profession.
Absolutely. It's going to be different as far as content-wise, but it's still going to be the same when it comes through, are your thoughts very focused? Are they concise? Are they directly to the point? Or are you writing with a lot of fluff and meaningless words? Mm-hmm. So in both aspects, you don't want to write with a lot of fluff and a lot of meaningless words. Mm-hmm. On the academic side, I want to address this because when students write, the writing style that we use on the criminal justice style is in line with the American Psychological Association, APA. To make some people's hair curl up. When you're writing those strategic or analytical type reports, you're writing it based on the fact finding that you've either pulled from various offense reports, even from your intelligence reports, and now you're going to put it in this one report that can be used whether for strategic planning or operational purposes. When you're writing on the academic side, you literally have to provide a source to support what you wrote. And that's where that APA citing and citations come from, especially when you start talking about statistics, historical events, things that have happened at a police agency. Well, how do you know that happened there? Where did you get that from? You need to be able to cite or support where you get some of that information from. When you're doing the reports that you talked about on the analytical side, you're still trying to be concise and write actual information, but you don't have to sit there and cite every one of those sentences where you got the information from, because you already know in that profession, that data is coming from police reports, intelligence reports, whatever type of analysis, raw material or raw information that you're using.
I'm thinking back, my big writing lesson, I think professionally, I was writing and a deputy chief read what I wrote. The way I wrote the report, I had a big reveal at the end. Probably in terms of Hollywood, it was probably pretty good because I left the big reveal at the end. He was like, you buried the lead. You need to tell them straight up in the very beginning, this is what we are going to do, and then defend that from there.
Right.
And so I had it backwards. I was building up to that to do a big reveal at the end as a big conclusion. And he said, no, you'll capture the audience better in the professional world if you start out with, okay, directly have your main sentence in the beginning and then defend it from there.
Right. You're being direct and concise, right to the point.
Also, why I'm thinking about it with a doctorate, if an analyst is thinking about getting a doctorate, what advice would you have for him or her?
If you're thinking about doing it and you're pretty sure that's something you want to do, go ahead and do it and don't wait until you get it. Not that age means anything. Don't wait until you're in your 50s to decide you want to do it. I think personally for me, it had always been on my bucket list. Every time a year would go by, I'm like, dang, man, I didn't. And so one day I literally sat down and I told myself, you know what? You keep saying that's on your bucket list. It's time to get it off of there. And that's why I went ahead and did it. And I did it in my 50s, but it's just as rewarding. But if an analyst is interested in doing it, if they go ahead and get their BS, then their MS, just go ahead and get it done. And you can still do it while you're working. Because I will tell you the greatest thing about doing it later in life. Now, I will say this, is that all of the experience that I had and all of some of the things I was exposed to provided me an opportunity to use a lot of different resources or know where to get a lot of different resources to use. And some of those resources, I don't know how I do it, or they're just filed up in my brain. They don't come out. And I still use that now when I'm writing or either putting together a lesson plan are trying to formulate something for my students when I'm writing curriculum for that particular course. I would say go ahead and do it if you can. If you can, if not, do it as soon as possible, sooner than later.
I don't really have any recommendation if you think about getting a doctorate. I have no desire of reading another textbook. Like once I was done, I got my master's of science and about halfway through that, I was like, I do not want to read another textbook. I was done by that point in time. So for those that want to go on and get to your doctorate, I certainly encourage you, but I have no desire to go on and tackle that endeavor at any age.
You might be one of the people I end up interviewing. interviewing, because I, one other thing on my bucket list, and that's actually the last thing left, is I do want to publish a book on, now you're an analyst, what's next?
All right.
And basically started from when you're an up and coming analyst and you start an entry level position, different ways you can move to different aspects of the analytical field, whether it's peer crime analysis, whether it's intelligence analysis, investigative analysis, statistical, the different avenues you can get to. And then if you opt to go the management route, what are some things that you can do to make yourself more marketable?
Yeah, there's so many avenues within law enforcement. And then if you want to even expand it farther and talk about analytical roles outside of law enforcement.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Several chapters probably in your book right there. So there's just a lot of different ways that you can use what you've learned as an analyst moving forward. Well, very good. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Annie, since you have all those years of analysis experience, and now you're full-time as a professor, you've been mentoring college-age folks for a long time. This idea, the gap between college and this profession, it seems like every person that I ask how they discovered law enforcement analysis on this show, a lot of people said, well, I just fell into it. I had no idea in college that this existed. So I want to spend the rest of the show talking about the gap in between college and the profession and how we shrink that gap.
Okay.
So from the, I guess, the academic perspective, why do you think the gap exists? Or why do you think that, you know, students are coming up and not having any idea that this profession even exists?
I'm going to actually use FAMU because that's reality for me. When I go to staff meetings or even when we go to planning meetings, we have these open discussions and start talking about, well, the courses that get students prepared for jobs after they leave the university are what kind of courses will give them a certain skill set when they leave. Then what always comes up is every student's not going to want to be a social worker. Every student's not going to want to be a police officer. So if I'm looking at the criminal justice side of it, because in my department, we've got criminal justice and sociology. Obviously, sociology has its own path for other jobs. When it comes to criminal justice, a lot of the students that I teach, maybe years ago, they said, you know, I thought I wanted to be a police officer, but now I don't. I don't know what else is there for me to do. And I'm like, oh, well, let me introduce you to something. I immediately start talking about some of the different associations, IACA, ILEA. I even talk about the different state levels of organizations and agencies out there to get them introduced to what the profession is. And so when I start telling them, I said, what do you know about a crime analyst? And I ask them, what do you know about intelligence analysis? And the first thing everybody say, you mean like CSI? And I'm like, no, I'm not talking about CSI. I mean somebody that, believe it or not, that has to do the grunt work. And they said, well, what do you mean? And so I start talking to them about offense reports, the information on offense reports, how you can actually use geographic profiling, how you can use hotspot policing. We talk about SEPTED. We talk about community-oriented policing, problem-oriented policing. I always try to build a topic that's related to any one of those things into an assignment and into a section in the course where I can discuss it and actually take my time and go through some of the actual experiences. And then they have the responsibility to go out there and do some of the research. The other piece of that would be to bring people in that's done the job. So I've actually lucked out and used some of the folks here in Tallahassee, but I've also had some friends who might have been traveling and they're in town. I'm like, hey, can you come by my class and talk to them about what you do as an analyst? A friend of mine who does stuff with gangs, they really love that because they say, dang, I didn't even know I could do that kind of stuff as an analyst. So the big thing we've found is they just don't know about it. I've talked to people who work at mainstream, and I don't mean any disrespect, white universities. And then I've talked to people who work at historically black colleges and universities. They just don't know. And once you introduce them to the information or provide them a way to go look at the resources available about it, it piques their interest. And they're like, that's something I might enjoy doing, especially if they enjoy, as they say, digging for information, which is what the research is teaching them anyway, digging for information. So one of the things that I think would be wonderful is if I'm actually going to, I call it sponsored, where I take three students, take care of their membership fees or whatever, so that they can learn what IACA offers. Because a lot of times, if a person can know the value of getting in on some type of internship, and FAMU does an awesome job with trying to get our kids placed, but sometimes the local agencies may not have a need for an intern at that time, but it can still provide an opportunity for volunteerism. They can go and volunteer and see what that agency is all about. Finding out what the person actually does in the job, and then finding a way to bring it into the classroom to make it practical for them to have an interest in the job.
And then what is your advice to them for the technical skills, talking about managing data and getting Microsoft Access, Microsoft Excel, those technical computer skills?
Well, actually, some of the classes that I teach, they're required to use some of those tools for some of the exercises they have to do. Like I said, I try to incorporate something in there that's not the everyday Joe Blow type exercise all the time, but something a little bit different. I can tell you this, when it comes to using different applications to either formulate data in different ways to look at it, Excel is an excellent tool to do that with, and they have to sometimes do that when they're looking at statistical data. A lot of the students in the research methods class have to use SPSS, where they're taking gathered data and trying to manage it, whether it's sorting it, whether it's cleaning it up, and then getting it in the system where they can actually do the analysis on it. Even with some of the other databases out there, one thing that we do have access to at FAMU is geographical information systems. One thing that I've proposed is that we actually develop an introduction to GIS course and use it just like a regular class. And all you teach in that class is ways to use GIS to support crime analysis or intelligence functions when you're using the application. So it's going to take some creative things that you do in order to either hold their attention or get the interest up enough where you can propose a class that you think you can probably fill with 20 to 25 people each semester, once a year, to get some of that training.
You mentioned internships and even volunteering. I am a huge proponent of both of those. And in fact, on this show, I've advocated that the association should have an intern czar, somebody from the associations that are going to work not only with colleges and universities, but also the police departments, and to encourage the police departments to have some kind of internship program and to figure out, why don't you have an internship, or what needs to be done to bring in the gap between the universities and the police department. What I want to do is I want to have an exercise here in which I am assigning you that position. So you are now the internship czar of an association. And you can pick ILEA, you can pick IACA, you can pick whichever one you want. But what are you doing to narrow the gap between colleges and the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, I think one of the first things that needs to be done is to establish a lesson plan, our curriculum for internship, where you have a generic type internship where there you've got your objectives you have to meet, you've got your learning outcomes that you have to meet. If you come into the internship, these are the things that you're going to be expected to learn. And by the time you've completed it, because I would imagine it's going to have to span either a full semester, which is 15 weeks, and literally have accomplishments for them to complete from week to week in order to actually grade them, rate them, if that training skill was accomplished. If it was not, why wasn't it? Go back, readdress it, have them look at everything from the basics, understanding what the different types of data would be, the different types of applications that you're going to use, what kind of tools are you going to use to write reports, what kind of tools are you going to do to go and research and retrieve data. What kind of tools are you going to use for mapping? What kind of tools are you going to use for any type of data management like you would do with Access? And then what kind of tools would you have in place if you're trying to make all of those things work together as one, come up with one final work product. And at the end of the internship, that student should be able to put together a makeshift strategic plan based on successfully completing all of those components, from the report writing to the report data retrieval, data management, statistics, mapping, all of that. And put it into one final work product. Almost, it's not a research paper, but it's the final product for that internship program.
You know, I think you had even mentioned that Tallahassee said they, or some local department said that they didn't need an intern. But the specific need when you identify something, oh, you know, this would be good for an internship. But I think I would also argue that even if you don't have a direct need for an internship, just having somebody analyze your department's data may bring up something that no one's really looking at. If you think about the analyst, the crime analyst, you think about the intelligence analyst, it can be case driven. It can be, okay, what's happened in the last 28 days, or maybe it's what's happened year to date this year versus year to date last year. And right, nobody's really looking at what does the last 5 years look like? What's normal? What are the patterns over the last 5 years? So sometimes we don't really get into that as a profession. No one's looking at that. No one's asking that question. So that data's not necessarily being analyzed.
I can remember early on, and I was fortunate when I was at Tallahassee Police Department, we did bring the interns in. Our only complaint was that let me put it to you this way. An analyst would come and be with us for a week, but then they would rotate them around the department. And so we always said, in order for the internship for crime analysis to be effective, we needed an analyst to stay with us. You needed more than just 1 week. And I remember a couple of people, one was a young man, one was a young lady. Those individuals stayed with us during the entire semester. And I know that one of them, when they graduated, one became a police officer and another went back down south and ended up getting a job as some type of analyst with it may have been a police agency. I can't remember the exact agency name, but those that ended up staying with us long-term as opposed to the weekly rotation were the ones who could see the benefit of the internship program. So I used to always say the internship program could be great, but that once a week, that 1 week thing won't work, because by the time you take a analyst that works in the unit and try to train or try to give them some things that you want them to do, and then you try to make an assessment on how successful they were or not, a week is not enough time to do that. So you need more than just a week. So I think if you're going to do an internship program, whether it's a local agency, state, or whatever, the commitment needs to be there that it's going to be for an extended period of time. And I think that would also encourage students, whether at a university or college, to seek a field such as crime analysis or criminal intelligence or related field doing something analytically based.
Again, you're still wearing your internship czar hat. What are you saying to these police departments who either not having a need, maybe they're like, okay, well, then we'll have to have equipment, we'll have to do background checks. Just go over some of the excuses that you may hear of why they don't have an internship. We're going to shelf the idea of COVID because someday we'll all be back in the office.
Yeah, someday we'll all be back in the office.
Yeah,
right, but so, just... So with anything, you're going to have excuses why something will or won't work. And anything worth pursuing or anything that can be beneficial to the agencies, you have to take a little bit of work. So again, it comes back to that C word, commitment. So you give me the excuse, well, you know, We don't have enough people to actually do the training. But the argument would be, but if you could provide a way to get the person trained, think about you maximizing another resource. Because see, now you can have a person that you train, have additional folks to do some of the things that you can free your other analysts up to do. Like look at some of the more in-depth or more complex type analytical skills you need done, because then your interns can do those other things that your analyst is already doing. So that would always be my argument, another way to maximize resources. And a lot of times the interns that the university put in place, they're not necessarily paid internships, but the student get the hours needed to graduate with their degree. So there's two ways that you can look at it. You're not just getting the benefit for the agency where you can maximize resources, but you also are benefiting that student to get those hours they need to graduate on time from their university.
I do hope that something happens with this because the internship is so crucial. I mean, I can't imagine how I would have got into the profession without it. I interned at the end of my graduate school time.
Wow.
Joe Ryan, I think I had mentioned Joe Ryan to you when we were talking in the prep call, and he was my internship coordinator. It was unpaid, and I drove a half hour to get there and a half hour back home every day all summer long for my internship.
You were committed.
Yeah.
You were committed.
And after that, Joe went to the director and said, hey, he's graduating. He wants to stay in the area. Do we have anything for him? Joe was able to speak for me, and I got hired on within HIDA, Washington, Baltimore, HIDA, from that internship.
And you know, and that's what I meant about you got somebody in place and you made a commitment and now you're invested in that person because they've honed in on those skills and almost made themselves indispensable in a way because you're like, oh my God, if I could get one more analyst, this person's ready to go. That's the benefit mm-hmm. of the internship program, I believe, if it's done correctly. You just can't have them come in there just answering the phone or looking up reports to verify a case number. You literally have to have an outline, a plan, thing for them to do, checklist of things to do, and they have to successfully complete them as they go through the stages of the internship.
Yeah, agreed. Well, let's, I always like to finish up the show with personal interests. So I asked you about your personal interest, and it was interesting that you said you basically watch any crime show that's on TV.
Any crime show.
Any reality show, anything. What is your favorite of all time?
All right, now don't laugh at me. All right, I know I'm 62. And Perry Mason didn't come out to 1959. I watch Perry Mason every night at 11:30. I tape it every morning at 9 o'clock. I don't care if I've seen them a million times, but the reason I love the shows is because I'm always comparing what Perry and Della and Paul did back then. And believe it or not, I even hear them use terms that we use right now when we talk about crime analysis or when we're talking about, well, what was his modus operandi? Mm-hmm. Well, what was the point of entry? I'm sitting there going, see, even back then they had it right. So I love my Perry Mason, and I'm an avid fan of How to Get Away with Murder. Not that I want to get away with murder, but I absolutely love the show. And for a brief moment, I thought about going to law school, but that went by the wayside. I think I'm fine now. I don't need to be an attorney.
Yeah, but you got that itch.
But I love shows like that. And you know, we talked about, I mean, I'm still a diehard Cowboy fan.
Mm-hmm.
They sucked this year, but I'm a sports fanatic. I go to bed watching SportsCenter. I get up watching SportsCenter, and then I switch to the news. I try to mix it up a little bit.
Man. So what's your advice for the Cowboys?
My advice for Jerry is to stay up in that owner's box and let the coaches do the job and you stay out of it.
That's
the Cowboys' problem right now.
Oh,
the owner.
Interesting. So, and you are a baker. You own your own company, Heavenly Pounds.
Now, wait a minute, Jason. Don't you call it a company. It's something I do on the side and I make a little bit of money at doing it.
Your baking business. Sorry.
My little baking business, and I call it Heavenly Pounds. Mm-hmm. You know why I call it Heavenly Pounds?
No.
Because, you know, they always say when you eat those sweets and put those pounds on, that's okay because they're just as beautiful and heavenly as they can be. That's why I call it Heavenly Pounds. Not only that, I do a lot of different flavored pound cakes. So I get creative with some of my flavors, and somebody asks, well, do you do this flavor? I said, nope, but I can. So yeah. I'm always trying out different things. And then, of course, other types of cookies or dessert bars or something like that. I like to experiment.
I got you. What's your specialty in terms of pound cake?
My 7 flavored pound cake are my 7-Up pound cake, because my 7-Up is a little bit different. I add a little bit of Sprite to it instead of just the 7-Up.
And then what kind of flavors are in the 7 flavor?
You see, now you're trying to get my trade secret. I use a little bit of almond, a little bit of vanilla, a little bit of butternut, a little bit of lemon. And I'm not going to tell y'all my other little
secret. All right. Well, okay. I was just trying to visualize what possibly all these 7 flavors could be. Actually, do you have an off the wall one, or one that's maybe at first you were like, but it turned out really well?
Yeah, a peppermint flavored pound cake. Okay. And you know, the first time I thought about it, I'm like, I might not like it, but somebody else will. And so whenever I go to the stores and I find these off the wall flavors, I'm like, oh, I got to get that. So I buy the flavorings and then decide which ones I want to try or mix. And then sometimes I might take like the peppermint and take the peppermint candy and finally chop it up almost a powder consistency and use it in with the flour to give it more flavor.
Now you got me hungry. All right. So, well, our last segment of the show is Words to the World. This is where I give the guests the last word, and you can promote any idea that you want to. Annie, what are your words to the world?
My last words to the world is simply, don't put a limitation on yourself. And I would rather be a plastic bag with holes that you pour water into than to be a glass box. And the reason for that is when that water spreads, that means there's no limit to my learning. I don't think you ever get too old to learn. You can always learn something. And that's my last word. Don't put limits on yourself.
Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Annie. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.